week's meeting.
No, it was last week.
Oh, look, I missed it.
This is a first edition of Henri Bergson's Creative Evolution. And the translator says that he's grateful for the friendly interest of Professor William James, to whom I owe the illumination of much that was dark to me. And he also says that Bergson read everything and approved it. So anyway, it's nice to have an old book sometime that you know you can't get a book today with that note in the front of it, which has copyright 1911 inside the title page.
Ron, do you have any idea? You said 1911, right?
It was written in 1907.
But the Encyclopedia Britannica of 1911 seems to be some almost godlike publication there. I hear it again and again and again. It's so outdated. Have you heard anything about that?
No. And this is a 1864 edition of Spencer's Synthetic Philosophy. So I'll make a copy of a chapter of each of these books for people to read so that you get a sample of the thinking that we're considering. I don't know if I'll get to it today or not, but we'll see. So Aristotle, in the Physics, and by the way, the Physics for Aristotle doesn't mean physics as we know it. The Greek word is phusis, and phusis means nature. So here's a definition of nature from Aristotle. And Aristotle's Physics, by the way, is very readable and rich in interesting ideas, and all philosophers read it, as well as the Metaphysics, which is about morals and God. So nature, and as opposed to intellectual and spiritual levels of being. He says, a difficulty presents itself. Why should not nature work not for the sake of something, nor because it is better so, but just as the sky rains, not in order to make the corn grow, but of necessity? What is drawn up must cool, and what has been cooled must become water and descend. The result of this being that the corn grows. Similarly, if a man's crop is spoiled on the threshing floor, the rain did not fall for the sake of this, in order that the crop might be spoiled, but that result just followed. Why then should it not be the same with the parts in nature? For example, that our teeth should come up of necessity. The front teeth sharp, fitted for tearing, the molars broad and useful for grinding down the food. Since they did not arise for this end, but it was merely a coincidental result. And so with all other parts in which we suppose that there is purpose. Wherever then all the parts came about just what they would have been if they had come to be for an end, such things survived, being organized spontaneously in a fitting way. Whereas those which grew otherwise perished and continue to perish. Such are the arguments and others of the kind which may cause difficulty on this point. Yet it is impossible that this should be the true view, that parts in nature should arise by necessity or not. For teeth and all other natural things either invariably or normally come about in a given way. But if not one of the results of chance or spontaneity is this true. Teeth and all other natural things either invariably or normally come about in a given way. But of not one of the results of chance or spontaneity is this true. In other words, the definition of chance and spontaneity is those things which come about randomly for no particular purpose. But those things which come about by nature come about for a purpose. We do not ascribe to chance or mere coincidence the frequency of rain in winter, but frequent rain in summer we do, nor heat in the dog days, but only if we have it in winter. If then it is agreed that things are either the result of coincidence or for an end, and these cannot be the result of coincidence or spontaneity, it follows that they must be for an end. And that such things are all due to nature, even the champions of the theory which is before us would agree. Therefore, action for an end is present in things which come to be and are by nature. Action for an end is present in things which come to be and are by nature. So Aristotle's perception was that everything natural comes about for an end, for a purpose. And this is the definition of nature under which Western thinkers have thought for 2,400 years. if we remember what we have seen over the past 4 weeks regarding the interconnectedness of life and the variation in a species which has led eventually to a diversification of species, and if we visualize those functions and appendages, those structures that are the object of the theory of evolution primarily, the structures and behaviors that are the objects of the theory of evolution, as far as we can imagine them, from what we've seen already. We probably would not have a hard time agreeing that, as Darwin said, all of those variations were adaptations for a purpose. All of the ones worth noting, the vast, vast majority of structures and functions, with few exceptions, have helped the entity survive in the context of the environment and in the context of the organs and processes of the body. And so Darwin has said that incident forces cause natural organisms to vary and adapt. And so there's the example that he gave of the duck whose wings become lighter and whose legs become heavier, and the mole who lives underground and becomes blind, and the mole who lives in the marshes and becomes a hippopotamus, and the mole that lives in trees and becomes a primate. Through millions of years of gradual change.
What is it if you say the other way around? It's just spontaneous thing. But we cannot recognize it because all what is left is that what is left.
Okay, what
and
gets,
what was in between, we don't know.
Yeah.
How can we make that conclusion? Yeah.
Well, because all we're concerned with is what is. And so whenever we see what is, we can see that it has adapted to a niche in the field of life.
That we can see, but we don't know why and how it happened.
We don't need to know why or how it happened. All we know is what we see. And so the whole theory of evolution is based upon observation.
And if it is wrong?
Well, chances are, if you consider all of the evidence, you will come to the conclusion that it's not wrong. Because the way thought works is by observing, comparing, and seeing patterns, and then comparing those patterns to other patterns, and eventually concluding that there is such a continuity in the patterns observed that you can draw some conclusions, even if you don't know exactly the material infinitesimal processes in between, you can reach fairly reasonable conclusions. For example, the example that I just used, we know from genetics now, but formerly it was only known through fossils, that after the extinction of dinosaurs, these shrews were small mammals that survived and diversified very rapidly to fill numerous niches in nature. And the genetic connection is very direct. Take the horse example. The horse was very small and had definable toes. But there are horse fossils all the way through for 50 million years that show that horses grew larger, their toes receded, they grew hooves, and their jaws developed for chewing. So there are fossils all along the way, and the genetic pattern is there all along the way. And so it's fairly easy to reach the conclusion that variations have occurred, number one. And number two, those which have survived were adapted to a particular niche in the food chain and in the climate and in the geography and so on. And so, what could possibly be wrong with that picture?
Was this idea that there is force, a conscious force behind, that leads to this adaptation.
Yeah, but we have not even asked that question.
And it was read out in this definition, as I heard at least.
What I was just speaking about is that we can observe, through the various examples that we've had, that apparently nature develops in a way that serves the purpose of survival. We didn't ask the question, what pushes nature to survive? All Aristotle is saying is that the variations in nature are for a purpose. And so Darwinian biologists, evolutionary biologists, through 150 years of comparative structural biology, comparative embryology, and comparative genetics, have in fact come to the conclusion that nature has the ever-present capacity and mission to vary and adapt in response to changes in the environment. And so nature, as Darwin said, the people who study nature tend to ascribe to nature, capital N, a general purpose, and the power to achieve that.
What is general purpose?
Survival.
Survival.
And whenever conditions change, she changes her structures and her behaviors.
What about the conditions which change? They are not part of nature?
Mostly they are a part of nature. Especially as we define nature today. And so one of the things, one of the ideas that I ended with last time was the idea of Richard Lewontin, who is a very progressive evolutionist, also at Harvard, and worked closely with Gould. He made the observation that organisms create themselves in relation to the environment. And by doing that, they also create the environment. And so he said, the DNA does nothing. the DNA determines nothing, the DNA doesn't replicate itself. The DNA is a molecule. But by interaction with the proteins in its environment, in the cell, it separates, it unwinds at a certain time in the gamete, and it divides. And that whole mechanism is a function of the whole cell. And so with the whole development of the body, the genes are stimulated at a certain time by certain enzymes to turn on and to turn off. They don't turn themselves on and off.
As I understand about the genes, we have genes that enhance and depress.
Inhibition and, yeah. So they're regulatory genes.
So
they're not the only kind, but they're called regulatory genes. And I showed a picture of one briefly last time.
So there's a huge possibility of what can happen according to what influence that is making.
Exactly. So the example of the regulatory gene, for example, the Hox gene. The Hox gene may determine that you have a head and two fins and a tail. Or it may determine that you have a trisegmented body with wings. Or it may determine that you have legs and arms, and that your gills have turned into ears. But it's the same genes stimulated in the context of other genes and other proteins and influences, chemical and temperature influences, that have evolved in a context. And so this context in which creatures evolve, internal context as well as external context, is known as constraints. And so there, in response to constraints, there's a kind of homeostatic pattern that the being realizes. It stays the same generation through generation. It doesn't vary in essential ways. Homeostasis is a principle of continuity from generation to generation under certain constraints. Every generation doesn't come out looking like a creature from Star Wars. You know, it's like things that work tend to be preserved and to continue to work. And so there are constraints and there are patterns of development. And there is replication and continuity from generation to generation over millions of years. Even though, we learned, there are minute variations happening all the time. So no two individuals are the same. And there's a potential for variation there in the genome all the time. But what's even more important, as biologists today are saying, is that there's a tremendous potential in the phenotype for variation. The phenotype, what we see and what we do, the thing that creatures are actually, has a very flexible boundary. It's flexible, it's plastic. The parameters are unknown. So there are laboratory experiments going on right now at Reed College with frogs, and it's a breed of frog that reproduces very quickly, and you get a new generation every few weeks. And they are examining under different conditions that they create for the frogs, their range of adaptability within that species. And this is called development. How we develop under different conditions can be very far from the parent. And
is
without... Pardon me?
Is this work that you just described here, is it available?
I saw it with my own eyes. I visited it. But yeah, you can get lots of reports on the flexibility of the phenotype. Just Google it. Lots and lots of studies with all kinds of species are going on to try to determine the range of developmental flexibility.
Have you found any conditions that are more stimulating change than others?
Yeah, temperature is one of them, and dryness and wetness is another one. Food, availability, and type. And so in the human being, what the example that's given in your blue book is where you'll see a diagram of a schematic of a regulatory gene, and it will say that this regulatory gene is for lactose inhibition. And so the gene for producing the enzymes that break down milk in digestion are only stimulated in the presence of milk or of lactose. And otherwise, there's an enzyme that's secreted that inhibits that gene. So it doesn't allow, the system doesn't allow the gene to turn on until the lactose is present. And so there you have an environmental cause. So in the development of the embryo, in the development of the human being, in the survival of species, Darwin observed that environmental influences are the main influences for change. But the adaptability range of a species is also quite great. And so if a species adapts to a change in the environment without any noticeable change in its structure, it's because it realized a potential that it wasn't formerly activating. But by doing that, it becomes a step removed from the parent pattern. As a result of that step of removal, the following generations survive within that new environmental, within the new constraints of the environment. And so they don't necessarily develop the same potentials that they had developed in the previous environment. And so if conditions change again and they drift a little bit further into another niche, then gradually the potentials are exploited that were previously unrealized until they have become quite far removed from the parent. And at the same time, there are incidental mutations going on in the genome. So there are two things working. There's accumulation of effects, of adaptation to environmental effects, and there's also an accumulation of minor mutations going on in every generation. Every generation is spontaneously different from every other generation. So that's a summary of where we've been already.
So where are we going?
I would like us to go in the direction of philosophy. Now we have an introduction to the biology of evolution. The philosophy of evolution is another topic. And that's why I have brought Aristotle, Spencer, and Bergson, and Sri Aurobindo. Because what we will be doing now is following another arc of observations and conclusions. All that we've discussed up till now will become a kind of substratum of accepted scientific information, which we can refer to if we need to. But I wanted everyone to have that picture in mind, nature. And then, last time, we concluded with the idea that in all of this diversity of nature that we can observe through billions of years and tens of thousands of species, with all of the extinctions and the variations and eras of evolution, there is nevertheless, underlying all of those changes, all of those forms that we recognize and can identify, certain common patterns. Especially, we know that the genetic pattern is always there, and it's continuous. So there is a unifying physical substrate, not to mention the quantum physical substrate below that one, but in the world that we can observe and study scientifically, the living world, there is a principle of unity. However diverse things may be. There's a, in terms of both continuity and structure, among all species, there are certain unifying factors, one of which is the genetic structure. And so scientists like Haeckel can say, I am a monist. My theory of evolution is monistic because I perceive that there is an underlying unity in all living forms. And I hope one day, he says, that human beings will be able to realize in their behavior and their structures of society that unity is also there, that we are one on all levels. We are one in our behaviors. We can observe any species behavior and find similarities with our own behaviors. Individuals, groups, insects, lizards. If we look closely, we will see that we all ingest carbohydrates. We all have heartbeats and nervous systems that transmit chemicals which do basically the same things in our bodies, and consequently our behaviors are very similar. So on this chemical level, biochemical level, like on the genetic level, There are many, many similarities. When we decide that we are going to cut down that tree, our brains releases certain enzymes that process phosphorus in the nerve synapses of our whole body, and we pick up the saw and start sawing. And so when the woodpecker decides that he is going to scale that tree and eat those insects, his nerve synapses are activated by the same chemicals that activate our nerve synapses. He doesn't draw a blueprint, but he knows what he's doing. And his little legs wouldn't carry him up that tree if they didn't get a message from his brain saying, that's where the insects are today. So, up to a certain point in our behavior, we share an environment with all other living things. And we share chemical, biochemical processes. And we share patterns of protection, protectiveness. And we send signals to alert our friends about what's changing in the environment. Are there any conclusions regarding the nature of reality? The meaning of nature that we can draw from these observations? When we start doing that, we cross the boundary into philosophy, knowledge, love of knowledge, understanding, comprehensive understanding of the meaning of things. Not just observations and reflections about what it is and how it works and empirical patterns. We have the empirical patterns to observe all the time. Now we step back a little bit and we reflect on those patterns of empirical observation. And we don't have to restrict ourselves to our own, because we have Darwin and we have Lewontin and we have millions and millions of recorded observations that we can refer to. So then we ask ourselves the question, what does it mean? Does it have any, do those observations have any impact on our judgments about what we do? Just think about that for a minute. In our first session, we read something about philosophy, the Britannica definition. The critical examination of the grounds for fundamental beliefs. Critical examination of the grounds for fundamental beliefs and analysis of the basic concepts employed in their expression, in the expression of those beliefs. What are the basic concepts that we employ and that we express that reflect our fundamental beliefs. So if we look at these concepts that we've been expressing, do we find there anything that is basic to our fundamental beliefs about the meaning of nature, the meaning of life, and how we judge things and decide the course of our actions? And then the question about the philosophy of nature per se, the philosophy of evolution. It's the exploration of the features of natural reality and their implications for metaphysics, for a theory of reality, for a worldview. For an understanding of human being and social norms and religious beliefs. Can we explore natural phenomena and find there some of the grounds for our theory of knowledge, our theory of man, our theory of right and wrong? This is the subject matter of philosophy. You right there? Do you observe in any of the information that we have discussed today evidence of something called involution?
If I use my background of understanding, I can see the DNA.
But that means that you impose upon the biological picture a concept which you think is necessary from another discipline. From Vedic cosmology or yoga or something.
Oh, if I cut away all this, I can see a progression. Clearly see a progression in itself.
Okay, let's don't jump quite so far into another realm of theory. Let's try and see if we can derive a theory of meaning by ourselves from what we observe in nature. Because until we try that, we're not going to be doing what's called philosophy. Now, I can certainly understand that somebody might not want to do philosophy because it requires a rather extraordinary effort of concentration. And not everyone is cut out for that. And in the Light Divine, with regard to the transformation of consciousness, Sri Aurobindo uses this phrase, it requires an extraordinary effort. So, it's not a matter of faith it's a matter of effort to try to understand the meaning of life on the basis of what we observe. Most people don't make that effort.
The point is here that all the definitions given already, that nature is that, and that something is surviving in the environment, all these definitions presume certain understanding in the mind, naming things from the mind. Naming them as representative in the mind, meanings in the mind, dealing with them in this representation. So they are as wrong or as right as any other representative system which may explain the phenomena. There is no danger in a way, because if I take these presumptions of Darwin, these definitions, as the beginning of our discussion, then I have to ask about the purpose. What is the purpose? What is nature? What are these definitions? On what ground they are made? Why there is all this environment and something which is not environment? On what grounds these definitions are made? Now, if we are doing philosophy, let us start with that. Why there is environment and why there is something which is not environment.
Good. Very good.
That's what I meant before when I asked, and environment is not part of nature, what is it?
So I want to comment directly on this idea. This is exactly the right direction in which to go. We can observe, just from the example that regulatory gene responds to a change in the environment, or the one species survives better if they change their habit. We can understand that there are involved in that situation a twofold concept. There is the external influence, and there is the internal drive and adaptation which responds to the changing environment. And so we can identify an important principle. Not everything is caused by external forces. Everything that happens in nature is not the result of an external force. There is also, for each individual entity in each species, a configuration which is unique, which responds at each moment to its internal and external stimuli. So while we can broadly generalize on the species behavior, we know that that species behavior is also the result of individual responses from the moment the individual is conceived until that individual is performing the normal behaviors of its kind, and while it's performing those normal behaviors, it is motivating itself. And its motivations are influencing the environment around it, which in turn is made up of individuals who respond to those stimuli. And so we can arrive at a concept of self. There is a principle of entity in nature. We cannot conclude from this information that all nature is just mechanically determined by shifts in molecular structures and environmental conditions. There are well-defined entities that respond in more or less predictable ways to those environmental influences. So one of the categorical structures that we find when we read through a variety of philosophers is this duality. This duality of things which happen in ways that are not determined by us, and things which happen which are determined by us. And so Aristotle said, nature is all of that which happens for a purpose, and all of that which happens spontaneously or by chance is something else. It's a definition. There is matter out there which responds to heat and cold and evaporation and hardness and softness and without life. But then there's this organization of matter which is alive, and it determines its ends. First of all, it determines its ends with respect to its functions. So it has the ability to hear, and the ability to speak, and the ability to eat, and the ability to build nests. And then it has its relations with other entities, so that it determines certain patterns in the group. But it's also subject to environmental changes which it does not determine, and which aren't determinable. They are the result of sunspots, which suddenly heat up things, and then the field of transmission is affected. Maybe it has a meaning. Interpret any pattern that occurs and assign to it a meaning. And the meaning that we assign to it may be the result of an intuitive, direct grasp of its actual meaning, or we may be assigning to it a meaning that we've learned from others is usually assigned to that thing. Or we may assign to it a meaning that is based on a complete delusional state of mind. But it's still meaningful to us. I mean, paranoia is very real for the person who is experiencing it. So that ray of light which is aiming towards my brain right now, and which I'm afraid is going to infect you, is pretty real. And it really does mean that. So my question was, simply, and I supply the partial answer to it. When we observe the patterns in nature in the way that Aristotle observed them or Darwin observed them, and we put together in our understanding processes the information that we have access to, can we determine meaning that we believe is important for our own decisions, for our understanding of ourselves and our society, for a true theory of life, the meaning of life, the meaning of the structures of our experience? When we start to do that, it's not necessary for us to recall the principles of phenomenology or the principles of Vedic mythology. We can think purely about this information that we have. We can reflect on it, and we can draw conclusions from it. And then we start the process of philosophy. And then we can ask, you know, if we can't really solve the problem that occurs to us, then we can ask, well, would it help us solve this problem if we applied to it some of the principles that we learn from linguistics about language? Can we supply some information that we've learned from economics? And so in this, Sri Aurobindo began to reflect on the theory of evolution. And I've just selected a few of his observations. But this first statement goes along this line that I just suggested. The idea of the struggle for life tends to be modified. This modification is a concession to reviving moralistic tendencies, not struggle for life only. The real law, it is now suggested, is rather mutual help, or at least mutual accommodation. Struggle exists, mutual destruction exists, but as a subordinate movement, a red minor chord, and only becomes acute when the movement of mutual accommodation fails and elbow room has to be made for a fresh attempt, a new combination. No, it's from Evolution, period.
This article on Evolution.
It's from the article on Evolution.
Right.
Which is just about evolution.
Yes.
And so, one of the directions of reflection that you could take in asking this question is, what do the patterns of variation and adaptation that we have explored so far tell us with regard to interspecies dependency or extra-species struggle and conflict or extra-species interdependency? And so many of the biologists today, like Lewontin and Gould, have spent a lot of time studying interspecies cooperation. And so they have, and even Dawkins, who's supposed to be a very hard-nosed ultra-Darwinian, has a whole book that he wrote called The Extended Phenotype, in which he describes a very elaborate theory that he has that our behavior, an individual's behavior, a beaver's or a scorpion's behavior, is actually affecting the biochemical structures and the behaviors of many other species in the environment. And when those species change, we also change. And so the at a very vast level, the world is our body. Not exactly at this point. The idea of morphic resonance is that that species remember how to continue to be species. That there is some field holding together the behavior patterns and the structures of the next generation and the next generation and the next generation, and that those structures and behaviors continue to be the same because of a kind of field memory that they have. So our cells remember how to be human beings. And so the mother says, if we really want to be more than human beings, we have to learn how to interfere in the memory of ourselves.
Not only that, I mean, the main thing about morphogenetic fields is precisely the study of interdependence, which is the main aspect, apparently, of life, which is also the main aspect in communication, in language, and the main aspect of consciousness. All of these things are about interdependence, and that's maybe the starting point for, like, milking into economy, into, like, society, into, like, all kind of things.
Very good. So,
I wanted to, like,
when you, regardless of whether you use the morphic resonance theory or you use this observation of Sri Aurobindo or whatever you use, you come to the conclusion that communication is about interdependence, that cooperation is about interdependence. And so there appears to be in existence, in life, not only an underlying genetic unity, but there is a unity on the field of food organization, procreation, habitat management, and so all species are in the process of building the habitat for all the other species.
This could be translated in terms of love also.
Okay.
This is about love in terms of
things. Yes, well, that's the Greeks. The Greeks would, of course, said the basic principle behind all of this is love. And then someone would say, well, what about the tiger eating the deer? Is that love? Yes, that's love. Well, I don't think it's love. Well, that's because you're deluded.
I've reduced understanding of love. You know, love maybe is not nothing but interdependence with all but hidden truths, and it can evolve.
Okay. Without jumping,
when it's aware of itself.
Without jumping quite that far, I would say that we have reached a point where we could say that on the physical level, there is a principle of unity and interdependence among species, and on the vital level, there are many structures that indicate unity and interdependence. Now, what does it take to move to the next level? What observations can we make on the intellectual, human, uniquely human mental sphere regarding this idea of fundamental unity and interdependence. Can we draw any conclusions?
That things are only in relationship. They exist. And this sounds very Buddhist, but I think Buddhist rejected in Indian culture like this scientific approach, you know, that is still like so modern, you know, that we keep pumping when we really think deeply into the same core.
Okay. Is there a relationship between these two entities?
Of course.
They're not alive. They have nothing to do with each other. They're just two bound volumes.
But they're books. That's all in common.
Yeah,
the relationship is having a shared reality.
Now, what is it that enables you, unlike the fly or the cockroach or the centipede or whatever, to determine this relationship? What is it that enables you to do that?
They're in the same space. Maybe space might be the common ground of everything that we should start with. You know?
We can even go farther than that. They have the same shape.
Yeah. Comes from space.
The content covers many of the same ideas as well, and they're both products of the human mind concerning itself with the meaning of natural formations. And all three of these books have that relationship.
But you could have all three of those books in your laptop and that doesn't have the same shape.
No, it wouldn't, but it would still have a relationship, wouldn't it? So what can you tell me about the nature of mind based on these empirical observations?
Malleable.
Your mind is malleable? I doubt that very much.
Well, but the relationships are malleable. I mean, our mind causes...
It means that you can change its shape.
Okay.
But only something physical can be malleable.
The mind can discern, for example, the similarities and differences between things.
Okay.
The mind has a...
What's another word for discernment?
Discrimination. Understanding and making differences.
Comparison.
Okay.
Similarities and differences.
Analysis.
Pattern. Yeah. Do we all agree that these two entities have those relationships that we just discussed? Do we share that belief?
Yes.
So on the mental level, we don't have very much of a problem determining and establishing the interdependency of minds. We share mind space. We are able to reach very similar conclusions based on what we observe. There are some aspects of reality that we understand very similarly and immediately. If we think just a little bit, we could probably, each of us could come up with 10 of the same relationships that exist between these two entities without saying anything to each other. If we study species, the phyletic order of species, it's we, mentally, who determine that there is a phyletic order, that all members of the class panthera, cat, the cat class, are carnivores. But this group of cat carnivores doesn't mate with that group of cat carnivores, and in fact they fill different niches. So we call them different species of cat. So we do this categorization based upon our ability to observe patterns. Now, Bergson would say this is a huge, huge issue for us if we are really going to understand the meaning of evolution. And his whole book is about that, that difficulty that we have, because what we're doing when we do what I just did is we are identifying forms which are distinct from other forms, and we are treating those as if they were eternal. Whereas actually what we have learned from evolution is that each one of these forms is changing constantly, and that there is a continuum between them, and that only 99.9% of all species that have ever existed are now extinct. So the species that exist today are a very, very small fraction of those which have existed. And if we're really going to understand evolution, we have to move away from this mental behavior pattern that we just shared and which is so common to us. Because something is going on here in our life world. I won't say the rest of that. And you don't know what it is, do you? Mr. and Mrs. Jones. But Bergson would say, and he does say, exactly with Sri Aurobindo, this evolution from matter and life and mind is capable now of realizing some of its errors and moving towards a higher level of consciousness which is completely identified with and grounded in the things themselves. Reconnecting this ladder with its whole integral field and experiencing something called duration, for example. Time is not what we think it is normally, and species are not what we think they are normally. And this continuum of matter, life, and mind is not what we normally think that it is. But that things that live maintain their pattern by a force that is their identity. And they maintain a behavior pattern at a particular moment, for a particular duration, according to what's right in order to realize that intention. building that nest, cutting down that tree, moving on to the next tree to eat those bugs. These actions, these behavior patterns that we recognize are actually being driven by a complex of matter, life force, mind, for a duration that is uniquely theirs. And that aspect of the existence of something can also be known. When we enter intuitively and directly into knowing. And that knowing is not just abstract. That is dynamic. And it is the power to unify the will of the being of the thing with the will of the being of yourself and knowing something called being. And what I find amazing in this research is that we have different philosophers at slightly different moments in the early 20th century coming to the realization that it is the being of things that we want to know. It's not their formal structures and their comparative behaviors and on and on and on in different ways of categorizing knowledge that we have. What evolution wants to do is know the being of things. And all of this time and all of these billions of years of energy and force and life and thought are actually moving towards consciousness of being. And when we postulate being as something else, some eternal form, we're not doing anything much different than postulating species as eternal species. But it's a strong tendency in the mind, and it has produced science along the way.
Well, if I may ask a question, it's very new, you know, it just came Sunday to the show, and I take it your background is in biologist, evolutionary theory. My question is, how would you link what I've recently read about the experimentation in the CERN laboratory in Switzerland in the search for this God gene? It sounds similar to what your explanation over the past hour and a half is trying to get to, in that there's this unknowable entity or quantity that science is searching for that's almost without mass. I don't know, it's not my field of expertise. But it certainly would be... See, my question with evolution, evolutionary theory, is that it's materialistic. This is much of what you're explaining in terms of species, and is this missing link to the God gene that they're searching for? Is that what you're arriving at?
Well, when you put together two terms that are so far apart, God and Jean, I think that you're symbolizing, and they are symbolizing, the question. The question that we're asking. Because we're also trying to move beyond materialism here. When we ask the question about philosophy, and that's my background, the philosophy of evolution wants to understand what the connection is between the inner and the outer, between the subjective and the objective, between the genotype and the phenotype, between the material and the spiritual truths of existence. Because we tend to float from one to the other and get quite lost. We tend to vacillate back and forth between the general and the particular. But it's very difficult for us to keep both in mind at the same time. But we want to, because then we realize something called the absolute. At least that's the theory in these books sitting on the table, that especially Bergson and Sri Aurobindo, but Spencer would say we can't realize the absolute, but we can be sure that it's always present in the finite motion, you know, the force. But everyone knows that that's not a solution to the problem, it's just stating the problem. So seeking for the God gene is another way to state the problem, I think. And let us stop now and contemplate for the next week what the meaning of our lives might gain from reflecting on the interconnectedness of the life world as we've been studying it. Now, I'll give you some excerpts from Bergson and Spencer to think about next time. Thank you.